Okay, so in Parshas Pinchas, page 876. Well, we're going to go a bit back, actually. Actually, you go page before to 874. Because Parshas Pinchas actually is an interesting Parsha. It starts in the middle of the story. So we need to go back to the end of Parshas Balak to understand the story. So, if you go to page 874, just so we get a little bit of an insight into the story before we go into Parshas Pinchas. Perachafet, chapter 25, Pasuk Aleph, verse 1.
Yeah.
And the Torah tells us the following. This is after Bilam had finished. He was unsuccessful in cursing the Jewish nation. Balak wasn't impressed, sent him away, and he went. And then it says, Vayeshev Yisrael b'shittim. The Jews dwelled, settled in Shittim. And the nation began to act immorally with the daughters of Moav. Money. There's Moav. Right. Vatikrenu la'am lezivchei eloheihem. These girls, they invited the people to the feast of their gods, in other words, to idol worship. Vayochal ha'om and the nation ate. Vayishtachvu l'leihayin and they bowed down to their gods. So vayitzomer Yisrael Baal Peor and the Jews became connected to the idolatrous worship of Baal Peor, which was one of the idols. Vayichar af Hashem b'Yisrael and Hashem was extremely angry. So in other words, the Jews were guilty of two transgressions essentially. They were guilty of immorality, having relationships with non-Jewish girls, and idol worship, which was part of the plan, because what would happen is, the Rashi tells us, they begin the relationship with these girls, and in the middle of the, when the relationship sort of heated up, they would take out these little idols and attract them to idol worship. Right? Now, of course, this story was actually connected to the story of Bilam, which came before, because the Gemara tells us that, in fact, this was on the advice of Bilam. Right, the Bilam was totally unsuccessful in cursing the Jewish nation, so he turned to Balak before he left, and he said, "One piece of advice I have for you, and that is that Elokeihem shel elu soinei zimor." The Gemara says, he said to Bilam, "The God of these people resents, abhors, he hates immorality. So if you let loose the daughters of Midian, and you start a situation where they'll act immorally with them, then." Hashem's anger will be aroused, and then you'll have some effect, which is the effect happened. Of course, many people died until Pinchas put a stop to it. Okay. Now, if we go a few psukim later, in Pasuk Vav, in verse 6, we're in the page 8-7 formally. Which is the end of Parshas Balak, because it's the beginning of the story of this week's Parsha. So the Pasuk tells us as follows. V'hine ishmi b'nei Yisrael. There was a man from the Bnei Yisrael Bo, he came. A Yakrev Alechov, and he brings to his brothers as Hamidyonis. He brought a Midianite girl. Le'enei Moshe, to Moshe, le'enei Kvod Asol. He brought him in public in an act of complete defiance and brazenness, and he brings it to Moshe Rabbeinu. Ve'heima boichim Pesach oil moed. And they were crying at the tent of the Mishkan. What actually happened? Who was this guy? As the Pasuk tells us later. This man that the Pasuk is referring to, was in fact the leader of the tribe of Shimon, one of the Nassim, right? Zimri ben Solu. And he picked up a Midianite princess by the name of Cosby Bastur, and he brought her to Moshe Rabbeinu. He didn't just have a relationship with her, he actually brought her in front of everyone. The simple reading of this whole thing is that there was a plague that had begun of Hashem's anger. People started to die. There was a sort of a court assembled that Moshe Rabbeinu had put in place, starting to kill people that were transgressing, who were transgressing the sin of idol worship at least, and the people of Shimon gathered to their Nasi, to their leader, and says, "Are you going to just let this happen? Like, are you going to just, you know, are you going to let everyone die and not put a stop to it?" So instead of arousing him to do tshuva, he in fact became really immersed in the Avera. And he took this girl and went to Moshe Rabbeinu and he said that he's going to have a relationship with her in public, right? Now the Rashi tells us what actually happened was as follows. He brought it to Moshe Rabbeinu, just to give you a bit of background, before we get the story of Pinchas. He came to Moshe Rabbeinu and he said, this girl, Muteres Oyasura, is she forbidden to me or permitted to me?
Cosby.
Yes. So Zimri brings Cosby to Moshe Rabbeinu and he says, this Shidduch, is it okay or not okay? Right? And what is he trying to achieve with that? I mean, obviously she wasn't okay. Obviously she was forbidden. He's trying to trap Moshe Rabbeinu. So he says to Moshe Rabbeinu, if you say that this girl is not permitted to me, then bas Yisroi mihi tira lacha, who permitted you to marry the daughter of Yisroi? Because you know, Moshe Rabbeinu's wife was a Midianite woman. Huh? Now, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't respond. And the question is, why didn't he respond, right? He did not respond because he didn't have an answer. The answer on the surface is actually fairly simple. He didn't respond because he forgot the halacha. Which halacha? So Rashi says he forgot the halacha. There's a halacha, the Gemara talks about a very interesting halacha. And the halacha in the Gemara is as follows. We know that in the Torah there exists, just so you, because this is important to understand the background of Pinchas also, what actually Pinchas did and why he was allowed to do it and what actually happened, etc. So the Gemara discusses someone who has a relationship with a non-Jewish woman, which of course is forbidden, and the Gemara discusses why it's forbidden and the various transgressions that are involved, etc., etc. Then the Gemara discusses this concept based on a Mishnah. Mishnah talks about someone who has a relationship with a non-Jewish woman in public. In other words, he makes an open display of the whole thing. So in addition to the regular translation, it becomes a concept of Chilul Hashem. Right? Now, what's interesting here is this, just to give you the halachic background. Although, of course, when we talk about intermarriage, we shudder, right? And we know that it's one of the sort of no-nos. But on pure, dry, halachic grounds, there are far worse relationship prohibitions than having a relationship with a non-Jewish woman. Okay? If someone has a relationship with a, if it's an adulterous relationship, a married Jewish woman, that's a lot worse. Right? There are various forbidden relationships in the Torah. The Torah goes through in Parshas Achrei Mos and Kedoshim that are serious, serious transgressions for which the punishment is capital punishment in a Beis Din, adultery, incest, and all the other types of relationships that the Torah outlines in Parshas Achrei Mos and Kedoshim, for which we find the punishment either to be capital punishment or some of them the punishment is kores, excision, right, spiritual excision. Having a relationship with a single non-Jewish woman is spiritually terrible, and it's philosophically terrible, but halachically it's actually on the same level. In fact, it does not fetch the same punishment. It doesn't get capital punishment in a Beis Din. Right? In other words, if someone were to be tried in a Beis Din with witnesses and everything, having a relationship with a non-Jewish single woman, it actually wouldn't be punished. Right? In fact, the Gemara sort of almost battles to actually understand what halakhically, on technical grounds, what actually is the what is the prohibition actually, right?
Offering for the parents.
So yeah, well, okay, we know it's ending the chain and all this. Yeah, I understand that. But what actually halakhically, you see, a lot of times it's a very interesting concept this, because we have to sometimes separate between, right, there are a lot of things in Yiddishkeit, for example, that we, it's an interesting topic
it's
in its own, that we look at as being more terrible than other things, but in fact are not. Well, they might be, but they're not on purely technical halachic grounds. But the truth is, we don't only operate on purely technical halachic grounds. We operate on many levels. But one of the ways we operate as observant Jews is we operate on halachic grounds, right? And sometimes things, when you measure them on the pure technical halachic scale, you actually come up with a very different result to how we view them, right? That's not to say that it's not terrible and all that kind of stuff. But on purely halachic grounds, not so simple. For example, the same discussion, by the way, someone having, I mean, we know that in Yiddishkeit, of course, when if you have the relationship, a man and woman have a relationship, it has to be through marriage, right? The Rambam says it clearly. Now, according to the Rambam, if someone has a relationship with a woman out of marriage, again, it's not an adulterous relationship, but it's prohibited. It's one of the loisa says, one of the 613 negative commandments, or positive commandments, which says in the Torah that if you want to have a relationship with a woman, you have to marry her through kiddushin, right? Others disagree with the Rambam. Others say actually that if a man and woman have a relationship out of marriage, provided that she's not a nidah and she's pure, etc., then technically, actually, there might even not be a a transgression. Now, I know this is not something we need to publicize, right? But because we emphasize that's. I'm talking about an ongoing relationship.
As in living together.
Right, as living together in a de facto relationship without formal marriage, right? Now, bottom line, it is prohibited, and if it's not biblically prohibited, it's biblically prohibited, and it's spiritually terrible, etc., right? So we certainly, if we were talking to someone, we'd certainly emphasize how bad it is. But I'm just saying, it's just interesting, on a purely halachic ground, it's not so simple. Having a one-off relationship, that is a negative commandment, it's called kadesha, one is not allowed to do that, the Rambam enumerates it clearly. But an ongoing commitment relationship is not clear what the transgression is. According to Rambam, it is a transgression, according to others, it isn't. But it's certainly a terrible thing. Having a relationship with a non-Jewish single girl, for a man, for a Jew to have a relationship with a non-Jewish girl, also is an avera. I mean, the Torah says lois yischatin bom, you shouldn't marry into the other nations. But it's not clear what that applies to and what according to what opinion, etc. Having said all, certainly doesn't get the capital punishment that other forbidden relationships do. That's what I'm trying to bring up. Having said that, however, the Gemara says that that's a spiritually terrible thing. And then the Gemara has a very interesting halacha. And the halacha is that haboyal aramis, if someone has a relationship with a non-Jewish girl and it's public, which then includes an element of chilul Hashem, it's a desecration of Hashem's name, the Mishnah says, kanoin poigin boy. Those who are zealous for Hashem, those who really care for Hashem's sake, may take the law into their own hands and kill him. Very interesting halacha. Right? Now, this is an important halacha. It sounds like a very scary halacha, and we need to discuss it a little bit, but it's an halacha that you have to explore because you really can't understand Parshas Pinchas without that. I'm talking about the simple pshat, it doesn't make sense. Right? How come Pinchas wasn't guilty of murder? Simply, right?
So public as in...
Well, I don't know if the actual act has to be public, but it has to be common knowledge, right? Because it's not clear from this story, even if it was absolutely public, because he went into a tent afterwards, etc. But bottom line is, if it's a chilul Hashem and it's a public knowledge thing and it's a relationship, you may kill it, right? Now,
you can kill the chap
and the girl.
Above.
Well, that's what. Yeah, and
that's
another
thing.
What's that?
Well,
okay, no, hold on a second. Well, let's take a step back. Okay, no, the problem is taking the laws into your hands. The problem is not killing. Killing is a sin, but killing is not always bad, right, as we know. I mean, in the Torah, you have to kill Amalek. In the Torah, someone who goes through a proper process of a forbidden relationship, sometimes it's capital punishment. The Torah believes in capital punishment. Yes, it's very rare, and it's very hard to implement, and it's a very careful process, etc., but the bottom line is, it's different to secular thinking. We actually do believe in capital punishment. At the end of the day, right?
Isn't it at one stage, I read somewhere that in all the days when Moshe found out that one of the women, she was a married woman, but they both had to die, and they were stoned. In the olden days, they used to stone them.
There's different forms of capital punishment, right? So
in the olden days, they used to do it.
Yeah, in the base, now, it was very rare, and it would only happen once in 7 years, once in 70 years, according to other people. Etc. But the concept certainly exists, right? So then, but the more complicated thing is this halacha, because normally when capital punishment exists, it exists very carefully, through a very, very careful process, through a beis din, you have to have witnesses, you have to have warning, you have to interrogate them, you have to match up. It's very difficult to actually eventually implement a death penalty. But here we have this halacha that kanoin, if someone is truly zealous for Hashem, if someone really, really cares, he can kill himself if it's at the heat of the moment. In other words, what does that mean? What's a kanoi? What's a zealous? The Gemara says, what does it mean? It means like this. It's what we call halacha ve'ein morin ken. It's a halacha, but you don't teach the halacha. Meaning that this person, if he would come in a calculated way to ask a shayla, may I go ahead and kill these people? Answer would be no. Right? But nevertheless, if a person is a real... Now, this wouldn't apply to everything. The problem is, what's the definition of a kanoi? What's the definition of a zealous person, right? That because the motives, a person is not allowed to do this unless he's absolutely certain that his motives are pure, right? And we know that Pinchas was. Now what happened was that there were many, many great righteous people standing around Zimri and Cosby. And none of them took this into their own hands. Why, says Rashi? Because they forgot the halacha. This halacha was taught at Har Sinai, but actually they were unaware of this halacha. They forgot this halacha. So therefore they became weak. They became actually, they didn't know what to do. This guy was going around making an absolute mockery of Moshe Rabbeinu and of Torah and Mitzvahs and of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Moshe Rabbeinu was powerless. He didn't know what to do. He comes and challenges Moshe Rabbeinu with this business. Who allowed you to marry Midian's Yisro's daughter? She was also a Midianite woman. Right? And the answers to the question, but the answers, of course, are not going to help. Person asks the question doesn't always want an answer. That wasn't the answer that he was looking for. He was trying to challenge Moshe Rabbeinu. Someone standing there with a Moshe, Elazar, someone, one tzaddik standing there that would really care, could have taken a sword and just killed him. But this Alman Halacha, the Halacha escaped him. So the Torah says, look at the next Pasuk. Pasuk Zayin, the seventh Pasuk. Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. And Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron HaKohen, got up. Vayokom mitoicha edo, he got up from the congregation. Vayikach roimach b'yodeh, and he took a spear, and he went after them, and he killed them both. And then the plague stopped. Right? What actually happened, Rashi says, Pinchas got up, couldn't understand what's going on, because he didn't forget the halacha. Right? He didn't forget the halacha. He remembered that there's a halacha, that a kanoi, a zealot, can actually go and kill them. And he couldn't understand, how come he's the only one that's thinking this way? So he comes to Moshe Rabbeinu, he says, what's with you guys? you taught us at Hasidai. We heard it in the Shir. Habola Ramis Kanoim Poigim Boy. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, well then go ahead. Like, I mean, what do you want from me? You know, you're the Kanoi, then you do it. And he did. And the plague stopped. He was right. Now, it wasn't that simple, because his Kanoi, his zealousness was challenged, right? Pinchas became very unpopular after the story. Even though he stopped the plague, even though what Zimri did was clearly evil, even though it was clear that when Pinchas did it, the plague had stopped, and obviously it was the right thing to do, nevertheless, he became the public, he was ridiculed, right? And we'll see what happened with that in a second. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu testified later to the fact that his motives were pure, he was a true Kanoi, and what he had done was absolutely correct. I think I've told you this before, but one of the hints in the Pasuk where you see that Pinchas was a true zealot, in other words, a zealot that really cared for Hashem, is the wording of the Pasuk. It says there, I once heard this from an uncle of mine, he said a good word, it says in the Pasuk, Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar, Pinchas the son of Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen saw, and he got up and he took a spear. He saw what was happening, and then he took a spear. He said that's very different from some people who walk around the whole day with a spear. Like, where can they use the spear? In other words, right? Right. In other words, you have something the other way around. That there's some people who are disposed to using a spear. Now, they just need an excuse, need a justification. They're always looking for something they can stand up for. That's not a real kanoi. A real kanoi is Pinchas, who in fact was a loving person. He was a person of loving kindness. But yet, there was a call of the hour to stand up and to stop a chilul Hashem and to stop this process. And therefore, he did it, notwithstanding that it would become unpopular. Of course, I mean, that's an important lesson. Sometimes one has to stand up for what's wrong. It doesn't mean... I don't recommend anyone takes any spears or swords, but nevertheless, sometimes one has to stand up, right? So that's what happened. What actually happens right after that? Then we come to our parasha. Turn over the page. So the pasuk says the following: "Davar Hashem al Moshe Leimer." Page 876, and Hashem speaks to Moshe Rabbeinu saying, "Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron Hakohen." You should know that Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron Hakohen. He turned back my anger on the Jewish people. In other words, I calmed down, so to speak. When he was zealous for my sake, and therefore in my zealousness, I did not destroy the whole Jewish nation. In other words, as Hashem, I was extremely angry with the Jewish people. Pinchas ben Elazar was instrumental in calming down my anger. Therefore, please tell him, I'm going to reward him and give him my covenant of peace, right? Interesting fact, in case you didn't know, the word shalom in this is very interesting. The word shalom in this chumash has a vav which is split. It's the only time on the whole Torah, right? I think you can see it even in... No, it doesn't show it in the Ashkel chumash for some reason. But it's got a break in the vav. In the Sefer Torah, there's a break in the vav. Any other letter in the Torah, if that happened, the Sefer Torah will be puzzle. But over here, the sefer has the vav has to be split, right? It's got a star showing it. It says at the side vav ketia that in the sefer Torah it's a cut vav. No, not the top and the bottom. What happens is the top is in the stick starts to go down, but in the middle there's a bit of a break. Right, so it doesn't go all the way down. To the, doesn't go all the way down to the bottom. There's a break in the middle.
No, it doesn't show.
It doesn't show. Most chumash with dashar. I don't know why it doesn't show it in this pasuk. Right? Maybe it's too hard to print with this font. I don't know. But why? Why is that? So one of the things is because he was given the covenant of peace, but it was through breaking peace. You have to destroy in order to achieve peace, and sometimes that is true. Sometimes you have to break shalom in order to achieve shalom. What was the reward? The reward is v'haysa loy lazara acharav. There will be for him and his children briskehun achelam, the covenant of priesthood. He became a kohen. Tachas asher kina lelakov echaparav bnei Yisrael, because he was zelus. Now, why did he become a kohen? Wasn't he a kohen already? He was the son of Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. And the simple answer to that is no, that he wasn't a kohen. A fascinating thing. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu made Aaron the kohen, Hashem said, Aaron and his sons shall become kohenim. In other words, Aaron and his four sons became kohenim. And then anyone that was born afterwards would be automatically become a kohen. The problem was that when Hashem made Aaron and his sons a kohen, Pinchas was already born. So he actually never became a kohen. He was the son of Aaron, but he wasn't a kohen. Right? But nevertheless, he was...
His grandson, wasn't it? His grandson.
Aaron's grandson wasn't a kohen. In other words, only the children who were going to be born afterwards would become kohen. Yet over here, Hashem made him a kohen. That was the present. The part of the master plan of this whole thing was that had he actually become a kohen before, it'd be a problem. Because a kohen that murders becomes invalid for the kahuna, and it could be even if it's a legitimate murder. So in fact, he wasn't a kohen before, but he became a kohen afterwards. Right? Then the Torah says, "V'shem ishi shol hamuke ashahuka samidyonis," the man, the Jewish man that was smitten down by Pinchas, that was smitten together with Midianite woman, was Zimri ben Solu, the sea base of La Shimon. He was the leader of the tribe of Shimon. Shema Isha Muka Midyonis Kosbi Basur, and the woman's name was Kosbi Basur. Roish Umay's base of Midyonu, she was actually also, she was a princess, she was from the heads of the nations of Midian. Okay. Now, why does the Torah start this parasha with Pinchas, son of Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen? Because actually, if you have a look at the end of Balak, which we just did, it says that it was Pinchas, son of Elazar, son of Aaron HaKohen. Right? So it seems quite a repetition, a couple of psukim later, to repeat once again that it was Pinchas, son of Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. Right. So Rashi says like this. Rashi says that Pinchas was the grandson of Aaron, but he was also a grandson of Yisroi. Right? Grandson of Yisroi. Because Elazar, just like Moshe Rabbeinu, who married a Midianite woman from Yisroi, so did Elazar. Elazar also married another daughter of Yisroi. So, Pinchas had two grandfathers, Yisroi and Aaron. Okay. What happened after the story of Pinchas? The Jewish people began to ridicule Pinchas. And the way they did what was to say, like, who does he think he is to stand up and kill someone? After all, he is a grandson of Yisroi, who was an idol worshiper. As Rashi puts it, he fattened up calves for the purpose of idol worship. That's what his job. He used to prepare calves, animals, for idol worship sacrifices. And he fattened them up. He used to feed them and fatten them up for idol worship purposes. And this is the Pinchas is going to come in now, become a ganze tzaddik, who's standing up for Hashem, and going around killing people. Right? So what does the Torah do? The Torah says, yeah, he might be the grandson of Yisrael, but don't forget who he is. He's Pinchas, son of Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. So he's no small person. He's like a big person, right? That's on a simple level. What's actually going on here? So the issue is as follows, right? It says that after Pinchas killed Zimri and Cosby, they began to ridicule him. Now, what does it mean they began to ridicule him? Either what he did was right, or wasn't right. If it wasn't right, then they shouldn't have ridiculed him. They should have tried him for murder. If they felt it wasn't right, then you should have been guilty of murder. Or it was right. One of them, make up your mind, right? The answer, of course, is as follows, based on what I told you before. The Yidden couldn't try him for murder because technically he was right. There is the halacha. If someone has a relationship with a non-Jewish woman in public, then come knowing pagan by. Then someone who's a zealot for Hashem can take the law into his own hands and kill him. And that's exactly what Pinchas did. So there was no way that legally he could have been tried. There's no way legally he could have been charged with murder. So the alternative route was to ridicule him and make fun of him and question the motives, question the zealousness. Was he really a zealot? And how do they do that? They did it in the following way. If you look at the careful wording of Rashi, they didn't challenge him that his grandfather Yisro was an idol worshipper. That's not what they did. They challenged him that his grandfather used to prepare the calves and fatten them up for idol worship. Now, why do they pick that example? Why did they... I mean, Yisro was not just a calf breeder for Avodah Zarah. Yisro was a priest. He was a chief pagan worshipper before he became a Jewish. Right? So why go and pick on a small little technical detail that he used to be involved in, rather than just say generally, look who Yezeda was. He was just a chief priest of Midian. Right? But the answer is that they weren't really interested about the fact that Yisro was an idol worshipper. So he was an idol worshipper. So what? Why does the halacha that says that someone can kill a person who's having a relationship with a Midianist is not limited to someone who's got yichus. Right? Any Jewish person can do that. That any kanoi, any person who's zealous for Hashem, doesn't matter who his Zayda was, right? But the whole issue was a different issue. The issue was like this. They felt that he's got cruel genes. That's why he killed. Why does he have cruel genes? They said, who was your Zayda? Not that he was an idol worshiper. That didn't bother them. Your Zayda was involved in cruelty. It's a supreme act of cruelty to stuff calves just to be shechted for a korban, right? Just to be offered up in Avodah Zarah. It displays a person with a bit of a lack of sensitivity, a person who can completely stuff up his calves only the next day to be slaughtered for an idol worship sacrifice is a display of cruelty. So they said, hold on a second, Pinchas, on technical grounds, maybe you kept the halacha, but were your motives correct? Right, were your motives really pure? Are you really a peace-loving guy that just did it for Hashem's sake? Or do you walk around with a spear? Are you cruel? And they question that perhaps the person's character definitely is influenced by his genes, and therefore your grandfather was a pretty cruel guy. Or he had cruel tendencies, at least. And maybe that's it.
Can I just, we never got that anyway through with you.
No, because obviously Israel did children, he became a Ger and everything like that. But nevertheless, he might have still underlying had. It's not his fault; he was born that way. But maybe he only channeled it correctly. But he still had that tendency, right? So that was their challenge to Pinchas. Comes along the Torah and re-emphasizes who Pinchas was. But actually, his nature, his personality, was not taken from Israel. His personality was taken from his father Elazar, who was the son of Aaron HaKohen. What do we know about Aaron HaKohen? Aaron HaKohen was the ultimate symbol of peace and love. Oyev Shalom v'Roedev Shalom. Right? When Aaron passed away, the Yidden mourned for him more than they mourned for Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? Because we know that he was instrumental in restoring peace between people who had a dispute between man and wife, etc. So it says the Torah of Pinchas, you have to understand, was an Isha Chesed. His genes were taken from Aaron. He was a person of love. And yet he was able to respond to the call of the hour and do an act of cruelty. And therefore his motives were absolutely pure. Okay, so that's why the Torah emphasizes Pinchas v'Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen. But let's go back and just analyze the story a bit. First of all, let's go back to the, because there's some fascinating refreshing here in this whole story of Pinchas and Zimri, etc. First of all, Zimri brings this Goyisha woman to Moshe Rabbeinu and says, is she permitted or is she forbidden? And if she's forbidden, who permitted the Midianite woman to you, right? So I don't want to go into too much detail, but just to highlight a couple of interesting things here. First of all, what's the answer to that question? You had a good point, huh? Yeah? Sorry? How do you know she converted? Well, you assume that she converted, right? Okay, so Rashi says a fairly simple thing. Rashi says, the answer is pretty obvious. Moshe Rabbeinu married her before Matan Torah, before the giving of the Torah. And therefore, so what? And therefore, when Matan Torah came along, she converted. Now, why would she convert when Matan Torah came along? Because everyone converted when Matan Torah came along. Right? So, it may be true that before Matan Torah, the Jews, and why did he single out Moshe Rabbeinu? How about everyone else? So truly what happened is as follows. The Jews were in Mitzrayim. Let's just understand what halachically happened over here. The Jews were in Egypt, right? The Jews actually all had a legal status of non-Jewish, according to most opinions. Because the Gemara in Yevamah says that when the Jews stood at Matan Torah, they themselves went through a whole process of gear, they went through a whole process of conversion. In fact, we learn many of the laws of conversion from Matan Torah. The fact that they had to circumcise themselves in Mitzrayim, the fact that they went to Mikveh beforehand, the fact that they bring a sacrifice, that they accept upon themselves the mitzvahs, etc. It's all a process of conversion, right? That was what happened in Matan Torah. So they were all converts. But nevertheless, the difference between everyone else and Moshe Rabbeinu was that when Yaakov, way back in the days of Yaakov Avinu, when his sons had to marry, obviously they married out of the family because there was no other girl to marry, right? Well, at least most of them, there were some twins, etc., which is an interesting question. But by and large, they obviously married other people. But once they started having children, they were cousins, and the family started to multiply, and multiply very rapidly, as we find in the story of Mitzrayim. So then the Jews actually started to marry only within themselves. That's what happened in Mitzrayim. They married within themselves because they stuck together, and they became, the Jews had a very interesting status in Mitzrayim. They weren't halachically Jewish, according to most opinions, yet. But they were loyal to their Jewish identity. So we say it in Haggadah, right? They kept their dress, they kept their language, etc. They were very, very loyal to their identity, and they certainly didn't mix with the Egyptians. So throughout the Golus Mitzrayim, throughout the 210 years of Mitzrayim, they actually didn't marry out, they married only within. Really, the only one to marry out was Moshe Rabbeinu. But halachically, it wasn't considered really marrying out because everyone was marrying people who weren't technically Jewish because they weren't technically Jewish themselves. Okay. Then when Matan Torah came along, everyone converted. Everyone. Okay. So Tzipora also converted. Now it's not quite as simple as that because everyone converted as part of the process of Matan Torah. Tzipora obviously converted separately. Tzipora wasn't at Matan Torah, according to many opinions. Right? That's a famous, stunning piece of information. And Moshe Rabbeinu's own, according to many opinions, his own wife and kids weren't actually at Har Sinai. Right? They were stuck in Midian. They only came afterwards. According to many opinions, they only came after Yom Kippur. They came 120 days later. Right? amazing little details come up in the Chumash, right? They weren't Yitzis Mitzrayim either, because what happened was, he married them in Midian, right? He married them in Midian. He had two sons when he was chased away. He was in exile. He gets the call from Hashem to come back to Mitzrayim. He goes back to Mitzrayim, he meets Aaron. He's with his wife and kids. Aaron says, what, you crazy? We have enough trouble there. What are you bringing more people here for? Right? What do you want to put them through? They send them back. So he did. He sent them back to his father-in-law, mother-in-law, whatever. And they stayed there. And then, meantime, Moshe Rabbeinu went back to Mitzrayim, led the Jewish people through the Exodus, through Matan Torah. He wasn't busy with his wife. He went up the mountain for three sets of 40 days, comes back in the Kippur, and Yisro comes the next day with Tzipora and the Tzad, according to all opinions, but according to some opinions. Right? So according to some opinions, they weren't even there. So obviously, their conversion was somewhat separate, but if you say that's the pshat, right? Rashi says he came after Yom Kippur. In Parashat Yisro. It's out of order in Parashat Yisro.
Yeah, I know, but it says that he came after he saw all the miracles that happened.
He heard, didn't say he saw. He heard. By Yishma Yisro. Yes. Yeah.
He
was very motivated. He didn't come right afterwards. He came after Matan Torah, according to most opinions. You know, there's a famous thing, I'll tell you just to digress a minute. There's a famous thing about Moshe Rabbeinu's name not being mentioned in the Haggadah Shel Pesach. Are you aware of that?
Yeah.
That's a famous thing. So one of the cute answers they say about that is, why is his name mentioned? Because theoretically, not the exact words, but in concept, Moshe Rabbeinu was the author of the Haggadah. That's why his name is not mentioned. Why is the author of the Haggadah? Because when the Yidden came out of Mitzrayim, there was a commandment passed on to the next generation, to tell your children. That's the whole Haggadah. That's why it's called Haggadah. It says, V'higadat to levincha, you shall tell your son, you tell your child about what happened to us when we went out of Egypt, right? Now, of course, the first Pesach after Mitzrayim, no one else could do that mitzvah, because everyone's sons came with them out of Mitzrayim. They were all part of the experience. There was only one person who really kept that mitzvah properly the next Pesach. And that was Moshe Rabbeinu. He was the only one to be able to sit down with his sons and say, now let me tell you what happened. Without them knowing, right? So he told them the Haggadah. So he's like conceptually the author of the Haggadah. That's why his name is not mentioned. That's a famous
answer.
Yes,
I heard the reason why.
Yeah, it's one of the ones.
Always heard it's not.
Look, one of the answers, one of the simple answers given is because we want to emphasize the fact that it all came from Hashem, that he was just a leader and he was just carrying out what Hashem wanted, etc. Okay, so that's a simple answer. So therefore, the truth is that the whole question is to be understood. I mean, Zimri wasn't an idiot. So he comes and he asks Moshe Rabbeinu, who allowed you to marry Midianite woman? I mean, the answer is so simple. It was pre-Matan Torah and after Matan Torah. Anyone come up with an answer? I mean, and also, why did Moshe Rabbeinu answer him? Why doesn't someone speak up and say, well, how can you compare the two, right? But the truth is, it's not that simple. The Mefarshim had learned a whole different pshat in this thing. It's not about Moshe Rabbeinu marrying a non-Jewish woman. There was a further complication. And the further complication was that Moshe Rabbeinu had a din of a kohen. Although he wasn't a kohen, he was a levi. The kahuna was given to Aaron, but we know clearly that Moshe Rabbeinu was a kohen during the 7 days that the Mishkan was put up and put down. He offered karbonis. And then after that, the kahuna was transferred and given to Aaron. But according to many opinions, the fact that the kahuna, the priesthood, was given to Aaron was meant that it wasn't given to Moshe Rabbeinu's children. Moshe Rabbeinu himself remained the kohen. And a kohen may not marry a convert. Yes, right? So according to some opinions, the challenge to Moshe Rabbeinu was not just, how can you marry a non-Jewish woman? The challenge to Moshe Rabbeinu was, how come she's submitted to you? You're a kohen. However, and that needs to be understood. So, what's really the answer to that question? Right? What's the answer to that question? And one of the simple answers to the question is that actually the whole question doesn't begin. Because if you know about Moshe Rabbeinu's, you know the story of Lashon Hara that Miriam spoke about Moshe Rabbeinu? What was the Lashon Hara? The Lashon Hara was that Eldad and Medad started to prophesy in the camp. You know the story? There were 72 elders, of which 70 became prophets, and 2 got left out. So they remained in the camp. And Hashem gave them the gift of prophecy also, and they started to prophesy in front of everyone. And when Moshe Rabbeinu, with Sipoira, heard that, she said, oh, they're becoming prophets, and Achmonis on their wives. So Miriam suddenly said, what's this? So Sipoira revealed that actually, since Matan Torah, she and Moshe Rabbeinu have been separate. Right? And the Gemara says that after Matan Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu actually never went back to Sipur. The whole thing, because he wasn't allowed to, because he had to be ready all the time to be called upon by Hashem, and the whole, right? One of the three things the Gemara says that Moshe Rabbeinu did on his own, and Hashem agreed. So actually, after Matan Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu and Sipur never had a relationship.
So did she never come from Midian? Did she just stay in Midian?
No. She came to Midian, but they didn't live together, right? So therefore, there was no issue of Moshe Rabbeinu not being able to live with Sipora. The whole Shaila didn't come up because the Shaila was not really a Shaila.
So he was separated.
He was separated. But Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want to tell that to Zimri because it wasn't public knowledge. Okay.
So there was and
he also felt, the Mefarshim explained, that really it didn't matter the answer or not the answer because Zimri wasn't looking for an answer. He just wanted to do his affair, right? He wasn't really looking for an answer. So for Moshe Rabbeinu Kekwa, but I'm just bringing it out because the question wasn't that simple. And the answer wasn't that simple. There was an answer, and there was a question, and the discussion was on a deeper level, but nevertheless, Moshe Rabbeinu felt that he doesn't need to reveal the answer, number one. Number two, the answer is not really what they're looking for anyway, and therefore he left it the way it is. He forgot the halacha that really Zimri should be put to death anyway, and Pinchas came and took the whole thing, and Pinchas killed him. Okay, now, once we start looking at the story a little bit at a different level, I want to share with you, and this is very complicated, but just fascinating. So I'm going to share with you anyway. But because I don't understand it all myself, but I'll get to share with you because it's just a fascinating thing. sometimes you find stories in the Torah that are upright on one level, and you start looking a little bit in the Mefarshim, particularly the Mefarshim that quote Zohar or quote the Pnimiyus HaTorah, the Kabbalistic part of Torah, and you see the story taking place on a whole another level. Right? So first of all, let's go to Zimri. Zimri, according to some Mefarshim, was not such a Rasha. Right? There was a whole philosophical concept behind the relationship between him and Cosby. Now this is the part I don't quite understand, but I'll just quote it to you anyway. This thought originates from an ancestor of mine called the Ishbitzer Rebbe. He was a Talmud of the Kotzker Rebbe. And he wrote a very famous commentary on Chumash called the Me'ah Shiloach. Me'ah Shiloach, the Ishbitzer, was quite a revolutionary sort of Rebbe. He was, first of all, it was a whole story. He broke off from the Kotzker. He was a Talmud of the Kotzker together with the Chedush Arim. And it was a whole story, and actually broke up, and he broke away and started his own Hasidus. And it was quite wild. If you ever look in his, wild I mean like in his approach, if you ever look in his Mefarshim on his commentary on the Torah, it's like very revolutionary. But he was an accepted tzaddik, he was a well-known Rebbe. And then,
what year?
This is going back, I don't know, I'd say about 150, 200 years ago, something like that. Now, there were many, many generations, there were many groups of Hasidim that refused to learn the Me'ah Shiloach. And one of the reasons they refused to learn the Me'ah Shiloach was because of something that he says in this week's parasha. And part of the problem was, and it's a fascinating thing, because part of the problem was that when he says this on this week's parasha, he actually quotes an Arizal. He says it's based on Arizal, and no one could ever find the Arizal. What's fascinating is in the latest print of the Me'ah Shiloach, that actually nowadays, you know, there's all kinds of manuscripts that are now being revealed and things that are being, and actually they found old manuscripts of the writings of the Arizal and actually found the Vort there. The Vort is in the Arizal. So which is fascinating. But nevertheless, it doesn't make it less of a revolutionary Vort. He makes Zimri a ganze tzaddik. It's like an unbelievable thing. And he talks about Zimri, he says it wasn't so simple, Zimri wasn't just doing an Aveira. But he says like this. He says that number one, Zimri was a tzaddik. And he says something which is, of course, is very dangerous to the layperson. But this is what he says, and it's got to do a little bit with also David and Bathsheba, which is a whole other story that needs to be understood also on a different level. And he says that with Zimri knew of himself. He says that he transcended normal physical desires. In other words, he knew himself well enough on a righteous level to know that he was not victim of lust, right? That wasn't his problem. And he says there's many, many levels of lust, many levels of desires, and Zimri knew of himself that he was clearly rid of these things, and he wasn't victim, he didn't have a problem with any inappropriate drive. And therefore, on his level, when he suddenly felt this incredible urge, and this incredible attachment to Cosby, he knew that there's something more spiritual here. As I said, that's a very dangerous thing to say for a person, right? I think we should just clarify that for all of us, when we have an urge to do whatever it is, it's just a physical urge. It's nothing spiritual. There's not one spiritual trace of anything there. It's just simply coming from what the Kabbalah calls the animal soul. Right? By the way, the same thing I'll pick up what happened with David and Bathsheba. Right? And that, in fact, is even more, because at the end of the day, although David was punished on some level, it wasn't like an affair of Zimri. David and Bathsheba was a proper union. In fact, out of that came Mashiach. Because David and Bathsheba actually were one soul, and then the Kapika Boy, they were destined for each other. They were supposed to come out of a different way, whatever the case is, but ultimately Shlomo HaMelech came out of there, Mashiach comes out of there. Right? And it's the same sort of thing happened, that when you read in the Chumash, I mean, talking about the Gemara says, whoever said David HaMelech sinned is making a huge mistake. And it says there that he saw Bathsheba and he wanted to live with her, right? So again, it's the same sort of thing. So this is and therefore, he quotes Narizal, so this is the revolutionary word. It was because of this word that for many generations, people refused to learn his book. Right? I said, this is not Torah, right? Among other revolutionary things he says throughout the Sefer. But, and then he says, based on the result, he says that actually it goes back, he creates a whole Kabbalistic thing. And again, I can't explain to you properly, but I'll just tell you what it is. He says, it's got to do with Shimon and Dina. Because he first of all, he talks about, there's three people mentioned in the Chumash that are all the same person. Because we say that Zimri was the leader of Shimon. But actually, we find before the leader of Shimon was Shlumiel ben Surishadoi, right, in previous parasha, and according to many shittas, they were the same person. There's also a person mentioned early on from Shimon called Shaul ben Aknanis. and it's all the same person. Shol ben Aknan, Shlomo ben Sushadai, and Zimri ben Sol, it's all the same person, depending where he is. And it had to do with the union of Dina. Dina was impurified by Shechem, right? Mm-hmm. Then if you know the whole thing, is that it was before Matan Torah, and it's also not understood how that relationship could take place. But Shimon married Dina, his own sister, which is interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a whole thing. Out of that came Shol ben Aknani. So Zimri was a descendant of that. But because he was a descendant of Dina, Dina wasn't yet purified, so therefore he still had to have a tikkun. And that tikkun had to do with his neshama connecting with the neshama of Cosby somehow. But it was, that's what was going to happen. And that so really the neshamas of Zimri and Cosby were actually connected, but it was premature. That was the avera of Zimri. It actually wasn't supposed to happen at that time, it was premature. And then some of the Farshim say it actually got to do later on with Rabbi Akiva. But apparently Rabbi Akiva, his neshama, according to Pikabola, was the same neshama as Zimri, right? And his wife was the same neshama as Cosby, and they got together legitimately, and that was a tikkun for the whole thing. And then they had 24,000 Talmidim, who were supposed to be also a tikkun, but the ultimate tikkun didn't come by because Talmidim didn't get on with them, and the 24,000 Talmidim who died during the Sefiras HaOmer are connected to apparently the 24,000 people that died in Shechem. You know that, right? When Shechem, it's wild stuff, okay? Just
you lost me a few generations.
I lost myself, so it doesn't matter. Okay. Anyway, maybe I'll research. I don't have time to research it properly.
No,
Rav Shimon. It was Rav Shimon. Anyway, so that's just. I'm just saying. You read the Chumash, but there's amazing things that happen. In a similar vein, which is actually a bit easier to understand. The story of Pinchas also isn't a simple story. The Zohar says that Pinchas was a tikkun for Nadav and Avihu. And it's based on the following Zohar. The Zohar says the following. Because it says, there's a Zohar like this. The Zohar says that after Pinchas killed Zimri, it's actually the tribe of Shimon wanted to attack Pinchas. Right? And when that happened, Pinchas got such a fright, he ran down on the floor, and his neshama left his body. So like he was like technically dead, right? And it says that the souls of Nadav and Avihu were floating around. That's what it says in the Zohar, looking for a body to come into that should bring them a tikkun, bring them like a correction for their problem, right? Nadav and Avihu were the two sons of Aaron that brought the foreign fire and they died, right? So they then went into Pinchas. And Pinchas was able to be alive from that, and that was the tikkun for Nadav and Avihu. What's that going to do? So the Mefarshim explained that, the Kabbalists explained this. Nadav and Avihu actually were also one neshama. But they were one neshama, part of one neshama that never found peace. Right? And their ultimate tikkun was to come together in one person. Which is why we say that Pinchas afterwards brought about the Brisi Shalom, about the Brisi of peace. Because he brought Nadav and Avihu together. How did Pinchas fix the concept of Nadav and Avihu? So what was the idea of Nadav and Avihu? Nadav and Avihu, we find an interesting thing. Why did they die? So one of the things they died was because two things. First of all, it says that they did something they didn't ask. They were very enthusiastic about serving Hashem. They had this incredible desire to come close to Hashem. So they brought a foreign fire, right? The story in Parashat Shemini. What should they have done? When you want to embark on an experience of coming close to Hashem, you have to consult. Right? They should have consulted Moshe Rabbeinu, they didn't. Number one. Number two, the Medrash says that they were guilty of another sin, and that is that they paskened halachas in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. And you know that a paskened halachas in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. You're not supposed to paskened halachas in front of your Rebbe, it says. Right? A person not supposed to paskened halachas in front of their teacher. This is some of the sins of Nadav and Avihu. But we know that Nadav and Avihu were great tzaddikim. We know that. They weren't Rishon. They were great tzaddikim. Aaron called them, B'krovei HaKadosh, called them holy people. But nevertheless, they did what they did, and the neshama needed a tikkun. We have this concept in Kabbalah called a tikkun. That sometimes a neshama goes through a process where the neshama is okay, and it's basically okay, and it can be led into Gan Eden, and it's a tzaddik, and done all the mitzvahs, but there's something wrong. There's a stain on the neshama, and it cannot find peace until it experiences this concept of tikkun. It has to have a tikkun. Right? And normally, the way a tikkun works is, a tikkun means when that neshama can attach itself to an experience or to a person who will re-experience a similar concept, but do it right. Follow? That's the idea of a tikkun. So what was their tikkun? Their tikkun was to go into Pinchas. Because what did Pinchas do? Pinchas actually did a similar thing to Danav and Aviyu, but did it right. Pinchas also did something that you don't ask a shayla. Right? Because sometimes there's a place for that. Although that's not the way one should normally do things. But there is a concept where sometimes a person can be on a level where you can do something without consulting. What did Pinchas do? Pinchas killed Zimri without asking. Because that's the idea. The idea is that it's a shayla, it's a one killing you do without asking a shayla. Because if you ask a shayla, you get paskin, you shouldn't do it. Right? And Pinchas also paskin the shayla in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. But in a time we're allowed to do it. Why did he paskin the shayla in front of Moshe Rabbeinu? He quoted the halacha that everyone else had forgotten. He quoted the halacha that Aboy Laram is kanoim poigim bod. If you have this relationship, you're allowed to kill him. Now, how did he say that? He said this in front of Moshe Rabbeinu. How was he allowed to do it? So the Gemara explains, because although you're normally not allowed to paskin the shayla in front of Moshe Rabbeinu, but when there's a chilul Hashem, there's a line in Gemara, b'makom shish chilul Hashem, where there's a desecration, it was a public desecration of Hashem's name, and cholkin kavod l'rav, you don't give honor and respect to anyone. When there's a chilul Hashem, you have to just take care of Hashem, not anyone else. So in essence, Pinchas actually ended up doing the same thing that Nadav and Aviyu did, but in a right context. And therefore, it was his body when Nadav and Aviyu were able to attach themselves to Pinchas and find a tikkun for what they had done. And that explains why the Zohar says that Pinchas was a tikkun for Nadav and Aviyu. In another place in the Kabbalah, it also says very briefly that Pinchas was also a Gilgal of Kayin. And he also brought a tikkun for Kayin. Why? What was Kayin's Avera? Kayin's Avera was murder. And therefore, that thing was also in Pinchas, right? Another, the Sochot Shavah talks about it. And therefore, when he killed, he also brought a tikkun for Kayin. So that's another thing. So I mentioned these things very briefly because it's a parasha. We look at the parasha because there's Shivim Panim LaTorah. We know there's 70 aspects, 70 angles to everything in Torah. Then we know that there's four layers to everything in Torah. There's the Pshat, there's the Remez, the Drush, the Esoteric. So it's just interesting to know. You learn a parasha, you have to learn it on all levels. You have to learn it the way it is, with Rashi and the Pshat, the Pshat. Then there's also nice to look at a parasha on a whole different level as well. That's all true. Yeah, so it says Pinchas Eliyahu, and that's. We don't have time for anyway. I was gonna actually do a bit of research on it this time because I'm not. There's a whole bunch of opinions on actually what that actually means. Does it mean that the neshamas are attached or the same person? Or, so I'm not clear, but maybe another time. There's a whole explanation of how the two are connected. But
a few of those.
Sorry, you were. Yeah, it doesn't matter. That's not clear exactly when that happened. But even if it came in after, it doesn't matter. In other words, the fact they're able to attach someone to a person who did that found their tikkun because he was a person who had done it correctly. So therefore, that goof was elevated, in other words, right?
So two neshamas can be attached to one person.
Yeah, well, neshamas are a spiritual thing. Because first of all, neshamas can subdivide, tikkun is a correction, right?
Yes.
So you
can have many. Pinchas seems to.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, you can have. You can have many neshamas come. You could also have one neshama being in two people, right? Because you have this concept of a. There's a famous question, right? Famous question. We believe in Tchias HaMeis. It's one of the fundamental principles of Yiddishkeit. We believe that there will come a time that the dead people will rise up again, right? So the question is asked. We know that we have a principle in Torah called Gilgal, where a person reincarnates, right? So we. In fact, most of our neshamas apparently are recycled, right? We've been here before. Maybe more than once. So the question is, when the neshama comes back, we have tchias ha-meisim, in which body is the neshama going to come? Right? Famous question. And the answer is that in all bodies, because a neshama is like fire, like a candle. So it's not a physical thing that you cut it up, it's less of. A neshama is like a candle. The analogy is given like a candle when you light a match from a candle, so now there's a new candle, but it hasn't taken anything away from the previous candle. So that's a brief answer. So you have concepts where the spark of a neshama can a neshama subdivides and regenerates, kind of thing. So sometimes you have a part of a neshama come into a person, but really it's a whole neshama. It's part of the other neshama, but it's also a whole neshama, and therefore it's not a problem for multiple people to have the same neshama. And conversely, you can also have a number of neshamas come into one person. So. And that was happening with Pinchas, Yevnadav and Avi, and Kayan.